future is now. And welcome to the SVK Crypto Podcast. 15 minutes of crypto fame.
My name is Charles Story. I'll be your host the next 15 minutes. Well, scratch that. It's Friday, which means that we have a very special guest on the show today. We have William Quidley. For those who haven't heard of William Quidley as of yet, I can almost guarantee you've heard of some of the projects that he's part of. So let's kick things off. He was the consumer products finance at Walt Disney Company. He, amongst other things, went into venture capital, where he was the managing director of Clearstone Venture Partners. He also co-founded Tether USDT. That's right, that was later sold to Bitfinex, something that we cover at the end of the show. After that, his journey into blockchain, which we speak about in depth, what got him into it, who introduced him. Everyone has a story of how they're introduced to blockchain, whether it was on a YouTube video, whether their friend brought them down to a meetup. But Williams is definitely one of the most intriguing. Now, if that wasn't enough, he's also the CEO of Opskins and the CEO of Wax. Opskins, for those who don't know or haven't heard of the firm, they're an online marketplace. One of the main components of their business is selling in-game digital assets, something that we speak about in depth, and blockchain's advancements within the industry, which is something that Wax has managed to successfully do. Wax is really interesting because Wax allows gamers to trade whenever, wherever, peer-to-peer. From the founders of Opskins, which includes William Quigley, it's now become the number one virtual goods marketplace for online video games, and something that we discuss in detail. And we also discuss the journey that Wax took, originally starting on Ethereum, ending up on EOS. Why was that? What made him change the blockchain? We're going to find out everything there is to know, William. This is one of the most interesting and enjoyable interviews that I've done thus far. Enjoy the show. Let's get down to business. So on the show today, we have William Quidley, the CEO of Opskins and the CEO of Wax. William, thank you so much for making it on the show today. How's it all going?
It's going good. Yeah, thank you. We ran into each other, what was it, a few weeks ago when I was in London.
Absolutely, absolutely. You were speaking at one of the big events here. So thank you once again for popping by the office.
Well, you're welcome. I really enjoyed it. Love what you guys were doing with EOS.
Thank you so much. And we're going to get on to EOS. But first of all, where are you at the minute? Because I know you're a jet setter. You're flying all around the world. Where are you now?
Right now, I'm in Los Angeles.
And Los Angeles is home, is what you call home?
Yeah, pretty much. Yep. Yeah, pretty much Los Angeles is it.
And from the start of your journey, was Los Angeles always your home, or have you lived elsewhere in the past?
Yeah, I was born in California, but I was born in a city outside of San Francisco called Oakland, and I then came down to Los Angeles to go to college, to go to the university, and I've left here and there a few years off and on, but one reason or another, I always come back to LA.
Do you think it's to do with the sun, the weather, or yeah, is it to do with the tech build out that's happening over there? Or maybe a bit of both?
Actually, definitely the sun and the weather. You know, if you grow up in the Bay Area of California, you don't know what people are talking about when they say sunny California. You know, it's closer to London than it is to Los Angeles.
And you mentioned Oakland is where you studied as well. So what were you? What kind of student were you? Were you an academic type, or were you someone who rebelled against the school system?
Yeah, I was always pretty academic-y. I loved economics, loved math, loved anything to do with sort of deep subject matters that had, you know, multi-hundred year long traditions. I kind of like that sort of thing. So I always loved school. I know a lot of people say I hated school. Yeah, that wasn't me. I liked it.
What did you do? What was your progression after school finished? What was your route? What were you intending to go out into the world to do?
Sure. So I went to work for a consulting firm that put me into the Japanese banking practice group. Now, to a lot of your listeners, they'll say that's kind of a strange place to go. back in the 80s, everybody knew, all the smartest people in the world knew, that Japan was going to take over the world. Japan had gone from, you know, just a demolished economy after World War II to, in the 1980s, it was second only to the U.S. And everybody thought, in a few more years, you better learn Japanese, because that's the economy that was going to rule the world. So I worked for a firm called Arthur Anderson, now sadly gone away. But they stuck me in there to perform financial reviews of Japanese banks. Oh, by the way, that was my introduction to the duality of what we consider facts to be in this world. There was the public persona. By the way, in 1980, I think there were, of the top 10 banks in the world, I think like seven of them were U.S., maybe two were UK, one maybe France or something. In 1987, nine of the 10 biggest banks in the world were Japanese.
Wow.
The only problem was it was all built on a facade. The banks were actually in terrible shape, and they just had very unevolved practices for auditing them and reviewing them. So nobody knew it until about 1993 or 94, when, you know, the government of Japan said, hey, they're all going to fail. You want to talk about bubbles. People talk about crypto in 2017. Let me tell you about a different bubble. In 1989, the value of real estate in Tokyo was worth more than all of the real estate in the United States. Think about that. One
wow.
city. And so, and the crash was bad. It still hasn't recovered. So I did that. I then worked also on some U.S. financial institution problems. So there was a financial crisis, everybody, in the 1980s in the U.S. It was called the savings and loan crisis. Gigantic crisis, the one in a century crisis. Of course, it wasn't. And the U.S. took hundreds and hundreds of savings and loans. Those are like banks that specialize in lending for real estate, and took $1 trillion of real estate because all these SNLs had failed. And I helped figure out how to get those SNLs either back into shape or to shut them down. But that was my introduction to something very important, which takes me even to this day, which is when you have these massive blowups, massive financial blowups, it is almost always the case that there are still very healthy assets. And often even the assets that have been knocked down in value can recover much faster than everybody thinks. I've seen it enough times now. You had the Japanese banking practice. Now, those didn't recover fully, but everybody thought Japan was going to go bankrupt. This is from 5 years earlier, when they thought Japan was going to be the biggest economy in the world. The U.S. financial crisis of the 1980s, by mid-95, no one was thinking about it. Of course, then the thing all tech people remember is the dot-com bubble and the dot-com crash, very closely paired with the telecom bubble and the telecom crash. Telecom bubble was $2.5 trillion of value that disappeared. And then, of course, we have the financial crisis. Not too long ago, we had a big bubble in crypto, and then that bubble popped. But my experience has been, now that I've seen so many of these, my experience has been that some of the best opportunities on earth come to people who stick around and look at these bubbles after they burst, and try to identify the assets that are actually still healthy or maybe needed some infusion but can come back. it's burned in my brain at this point. In fact, during the financial crisis, this last one in the United States, my partners and I, recalling what had happened in the financial crisis in the 1980s, where a lot of real estate was dumped at very low prices, we went and bought real estate. And here's what's interesting. It took, I'd say, less than 2 years for the, quote, great deals in real estate in the U.S. to completely disappear after the U.S. financial crisis. And I think this is because it's becoming much more obvious to a larger number of people that therein lies opportunities. And of course, this brings us to crypto. But briefly, after I did my stint as a consultant, I worked for the Walt Disney Company, where I was running all the financial operations for the Walt Disney's licensing portfolio. Disney's the largest licensor. And everybody, you know, knows their characters, Mickey, Minnie, Donald, Goofy, all those. Now Marvel and Star Wars and others. So I did that. And it was there when I was at Disney working away that the Mosaic browser came about. And this is the browser that a guy named Mark Andreessen helped build at the University of Illinois at Champaign. I think it was in 93 or 94. Anyway, he took that browser and he went to Silicon Valley. He got some venture capital and he renamed it Netscape. And that was essentially just putting a front end, what we now call a UI, on the internet. Because the internet, of course, had been around for decades, but no one had an easy way to use it. And I saw it. It was 1994, and I got the bug. And as quickly as I could, I started to think about ways to take advantage of this internet revolution. And ultimately, I partnered with a couple of other guys, and we raised a venture capital fund that was associated with, at the time, I think it was the world's first technology incubator, and it was called Idea Lab. And Idea Lab, for those of you who don't remember, was the was like the shining star of the 1990s when it came to startup or really early stage, what now we call incubation style investing. And it was magnificent. We had at any given time maybe 20 teams, and we would just come up with ideas. Bill Gross, the founder of Idea Lab, came up with virtually all of them. and then my partners and I would evaluate which ones we thought were really high quality, and then we'd give them a little bit of venture capital. And then if they kept doing well, we'd introduce another VCs. I remember, by the way, when we first started doing this, several VCs were sort of bothered by this incubator concept. They thought it was sort of cheating. They're like, look at what you're doing. You're raising money for companies that you guys built. That's not fair. Whatever. 15 years later, lots of VCs now do that.
Things have changed.
Yeah, things have definitely changed. And so briefly then, I did venture capital during the bubble, wonderful time. After the bubble, it sucked. And that, by the way, I would say Silicon Valley and just startup venture style investing was affected negatively by the dot-com bubble and then the telecom bubble for probably 10 years. Now, yes, in 2005, you had, you know, Facebook and you had Zynga in 2007 or so. You had companies, but the 2000s were a rough period for venture capital. And it was after the financial crisis of 2008 that I started thinking this venture model is not all that exciting. I was wondering what other big transformational technology is going to come about. Of course, one hit me right in the face called Bitcoin and blockchain. And you know what? it took me 2 years to take it seriously. My partner in 2010, someone I had worked with in a lot of video gaming stuff, he was a technologist, and he introduced me to Bitcoin in 2010. And you see, one problem venture capitalists have is we have scar tissue from old deals. I had done some what I will call magic internet money type of investing back in the 90s. There were companies like Flues and Beans, companies you've never heard of, but they were offering internet money. Of course, they weren't on a blockchain, but no one was thinking blockchain. So, but they didn't work out so well. So I was thinking, this is not that interesting. And he kept persistently bugging me. It wasn't until I was in Singapore in 2012 that I was meeting with a friend of mine, and she had run a video gaming virtual item exchange in Singapore. And she's asked me, what do you think about this Bitcoin stuff? I'm really thinking of using it, maybe accepting it as a deposit. And then as I flew back from Singapore, I thought, okay, I'm hearing from two smart people now, maybe I'll take a look. And so in 2012, I decided to come back to LA, and I said to my old partner, you got like one day to convince me this is interesting. And you know what's interesting? It didn't take him that long once he started talking about the blockchain mechanic. We had always talked about Bitcoin itself. And when he talked about blockchain, I really thought, this is cool stuff. And then from there, my partner and I did nothing but Bitcoin blockchain until about mid-2015. And in mid-2015, the overall market had gone up nicely. The problem was no one was using it in day-to-day activities. And then we decided, you know what? What if we were to bring crypto to our old industry of virtual item trading? And so we partnered with the two guys who had founded Opskins, which is a very large site where you can buy and sell in-game virtual items. And we talked to them about crypto and all that. They got excited. We invested. Ultimately, we bought the company. I became the CEO. My partner became the COO. And then, of course, in 2016, we thought, what if we put this on a decentralized platform? So that was the genesis for the Wax blockchain, which we did a token generation event for in 2017. And by the way, in June, late June of this year, so a couple of months away, the Wax blockchain will launch. So that takes you up to where we are now.
Wow. Thank you so much for giving the insight there. I mean, one quick question is that, you know, Opskins itself is a centralized marketplace, right? I mean, what were the advantages to Wax being decentralized? What were your views on that?
Yeah, well, first I'll say this, which may be heresy to all crypto people, but my point of view is this. Decentralization is the worst possible way to do just about everything. There are a few things where it's wonderful, but for most things, it's terrible, which is why we don't have decentralized businesses. In fact, what's the biggest problem with corporations in the world today? Governments have to intervene because big businesses get even bigger. And that's because of things like the economies of scale and networking effects. So we like big businesses. We like centralized businesses because we like one throat to choke when we have problems. You just go to that business. Now, like I said, decentralizing is really a bad idea for most things, but there's a few things, I think three or four things for which it's absolutely wonderful. One of those is trading of virtual items. And I'll tell you why. For those people who don't know how, let's say, the video game item trading market works. But you can buy virtual items. In fact, it's the primary business model of most video game companies. Most of them don't charge you to use the game anymore. They have what's called a free-to-play model, where you can download the game, you can use it, But if you want to, frankly, do better, we call it, if you actually want to win, you you pay to win. You buy virtual items that either give you certain utility in the game, better powers and whatnot. Or, by the way, there are also virtual items, the ones I focus on, that have strictly cosmetic value. But a lot of people like dressing up their characters. It might not help them win the game, but they look cool while they're losing, so they feel better. but here's the thing. Nearly all video games in the world, and I should say, virtual item sales in video games globally is about 100 billion USD a year. That's a very big number. Wow. All video games generate globally about 150 billion annually, but 100 billion of the 150 billion is just selling these little virtual items. And an increasingly larger and larger percentage of those virtual items are strictly cosmetics, meaning they're sort of clothes that you put on your avatar, finishes you put on your weapons, but they have no in-game utility. But for the most part, video game companies do not like people trading their virtual items. And in fact, if you ever are really bored and you read the terms of service for virtual items in a video game that you buy, what you will note is you did not buy them. You basically rented them. They call it a limited use license. Now, that may be fine, you might think. Well, who cares? Well, this is where you might care. I mentioned consumers spend $100 billion a year on these virtual items, but they don't own them. That's a lot of money to just throw away. And the thing is, because they're digital in form, it would be very easy to allow those virtual items to exist in a wallet and to allow people to resell them. Almost everything in life that we buy as consumers, we can resell, from your car to your home to, heck, your iPhone. Go to eBay or Craigslist or any of the other trading apps, and what you will see is people like to sell their secondhand goods. But in the video game world, as a policy, most don't let you do that. So here was our thinking. That is an antiquated business model. And now that we have a way for you to own a virtual item and have great confidence that no one can take it from you, and that's by doing it on a blockchain, we thought video games, and there'll be a path we can talk about more how this will actually evolve, but video games, ultimately, when you buy a virtual item, you'll be able to own that. It won't be a license. It will be a sale to you, and you can do as you wish with it down the road. I think this is a really nice application for blockchains. And again, and we can also talk about what type of blockchains. Wax, for instance, is using the delegated proof of stake consensus mechanism that Dan Larimer, inventor of EOS, created. And at some point in the podcast, if you want, we can talk about that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, first of all, let's talk about Wax, right? Because when it was first built out, you used Ethereum, and then you decided to move over to EOS. What was the reason behind the move?
Yeah, depression, panic, sadness, going broke. Pick your term. My partner and I, we were the second largest buyers of Ethereum in the Ethereum crowd sale. So I say that only to make a point that we really like Ethereum. The concept of a virtual machine on a blockchain is wonderful. In fact, we invested in the very first blockchain to do that, to put an intelligent layer on a blockchain that was called MasterCoin, where many of the Ethereum founding devs came from. So we really liked it, but it works off a consensus mechanism. And I assume some of your podcast listeners are familiar with that. Some aren't, but it works off a consensus mechanism called proof of work. And suffice to say that the way that works is for every transaction to be validated as authentic and go be, you know, snugly attached into the blockchain, a bunch of people working independently on their computers have to solve some math problems and confirm it. Well, that is actually a terrific way to create a very secure blockchain. I'll go as far as to say, I think proof of work blockchains are the most secure. Now, why then did we get off the Ethereum blockchain if it's so secure? Well, the security comes at a terribly high price, and that is the speed at which transactions can be transmitted. And what we found was that the Ethereum blockchain was fine when we first started putting a few transactions on it. But when we started putting a lot more, and then when congestion hit the Ethereum blockchain, all hell broke loose. That happened, for us anyway, in late June, early July 2018. And I'll just give a little bit more about Ethereum. When Ethereum, the way it's designed, is when there's congestion, too many people trying to do transactions, it converts to what I would call a surge pricing model, just like Uber charges more during the busy hours of the day. Well, that's essentially what Ethereum does. Miners charge you more when they have a lot more transactions trying to be processed. You could call that fair. It is fair, but it's very inconvenient and impractical for businesses like ours. Because our customers, when people check out of our marketplace, they want to get their merchandise immediately. Who wants to sit there for a long period of time? So I'll give you three stats, which will tell you why Ethereum didn't work for us.
Let's go.
We were paying about, which was a lot, but we could deal with it. We were paying about 50 cents to process each transaction on the Ethereum blockchain. We were, it was taking about, I want to say maybe 90 seconds, 60 seconds to 90 seconds. And it was costing us perhaps, like I said, 50 cents. It was tolerable. We didn't like it so much.
How many transactions were you doing?
We were doing maybe a few. We were doing a few thousand an hour, so it was okay.
Wow.
After an event occurred, and we can talk more about this later, but Ethereum is a permissionless blockchain. So anybody can just start using it. So some fools decided to use Ethereum blockchain in late June of 2018 for a crazy promotion. I think they were an exchange. And it involved basically people sending them very small quantities from different Ethereum addresses to their exchange. And the congestion became impossible. We went from spending 50 cents to $40 in order to process a transaction. We went from it taking essentially a minute or two to taking 17 hours to process a transaction. So when that happened, I said to my guys, we're going to be bankrupt if we have to put up with this. And so what we did is we very rapidly came out with I'd call it a pre-alpha version of the Wax blockchain. It wasn't ready for prime time, but Block One had just released the EOS blockchain. And we were able to take some pieces of that, put it into ours, and good to go. And here's what I'll say. That took a couple of weeks and it was very painful while we were waiting. I had two big takeaways from this. One, you can't run an industrial scale business on a proof of work blockchain as of 2018 and now 2019. It won't scale. Two, permissionless blockchains, which means, you know, anybody can use it. For the audience who's not as familiar with that, you don't have to go and get approval. It's not like putting your app in an app store. You just, which requires you to get permission from Google or Apple. You can just put your dApp on a permissionless blockchain and start using it. I don't think permission blockchains are practical for companies. And so at least for companies today who are using proof of work as a concept, it remains to be seen if we can have permissionless blockchains with, let's say, not yet industrial scale, but commercial scale, small businesses. I think that works. We're seeing it work on EOS. We're even some of the blockchains that Dan Larimer did in the past, like Steam and BitShares. It appears that delegated proof of stake as a consensus mechanism is at least good enough for now for the types of transactions volume that is occurring. And I'll tell you this, we the Wax blockchain, we got up to about 6 million transactions every 24 hours. So that's hundreds and hundreds per minute or per second. That tells you something when you look at, there's a site called Blocktivity. I think it's blocktivity.com, yeah, which shows you, very helpful, every, like the top 20 blockchains by transaction volume. And for the audience who are EOS fans, you'll note that number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I think, in there are all delegated proof of stake consensus style blockchains. So at least for now, we're sort of all thinking this is the best way of processing transactions on a blockchain.
So you're originally connected to the delegated proof of stake blockchain before you joined Ethereum. What was your initial thoughts on that? Were you unsure that it could scale? What was kind of your original drawbacks? Obviously, now that you've built Wax, yeah, as a sidechain, but I know that you've been familiar with the delegated proof of stake blockchain for quite a while. What were your initial thoughts?
My initial thoughts were we need something that can scale, right? We need a blockchain that can scale, and we need a blockchain where the price you pay is predictable. Business people don't have to get a dirt cheap deal all the time. In fact, I tell lots of entrepreneurs, you know, as a venture capitalist for 20 years, that most businesses have a lot more confidence when they have a vendor who they pay and pay a decent amount to than when they have a vendor who doesn't charge them. You want your vendors to be financially healthy. So my thinking of the proof, delegated proof of stake consensus mechanism was that it was sure to be faster and sure to be cheaper. And that's simply because of the mechanics of validating a transaction using proof of work. Now, as you know, there are many different attempts to create some sort of consensus mechanism and delegated proof of stake, traditional proof of stake, proof of work, and all kinds of other hybrids. But I think the one that I had the most confidence in was delegated proof of stake, frankly, because Dan Larimer, the inventor of it, seemed quite practical in the way he looked at things. And so we felt like you never know how a blockchain is going to perform, right, before it actually launches.
Of course.
But I will say this, having done a few blockchain-related projects, right? My partners and I invented this thing called Tether. We were very early in MasterCoin. Still, by the way, using Tether still uses MasterCoin, little fun fact, which is pretty crazy. Tether trades, what, $3 or $4 trillion US dollars a year annualized. It's done on the MasterCoin. I think it's now called Omni blockchain. But you can see that a lot of the people who are thinking of very high frequency sort of throughput and businesses like ours, we're all leaning towards DPoS, delegated proof of stake. But I can also say this, there is nothing more enlightening as a business person, or I would even say as an investor. So for any of your listeners who are venture capitalists investing in blockchain projects, you all know that learning through reading a book, learning through attending a university lecture will never equal learning from doing. And when you actually have to build a blockchain and you have to build it to reach certain parameters, performance parameters, you see the good and the bad. The one thing I will say about DPoS is it's working. And it has tremendous, I think, scale capabilities. It's a more complicated blockchain to run, and this is because of this delegated word in the proof of stake consensus mechanism. You need people to vote. Literally, as a token holder, you do what we call staking. And by staking, you are claiming I have X amount of tokens, could be EOS tokens or WAX tokens. And as a result, I have skin in the game in this thing, and I want my voice heard, and I'm going to vote. That all sounds great, but there is a serious problem with voter apathy. It turns out most people don't care to vote, but why do I care about this and EOS cares about this? Because we need people, we need the community very engaged to be voting on changes to the blockchain, changes that hopefully will improve the blockchain. So one of the things that we did at WAX was we looked at the launch of EOS and we saw that governance, which is what this voting is part of, governance is the problem, or is one of the weaknesses of delegated proof of stake. So we have lots of friends at Block One, the creators of EOS, and some of those have actually left and started other companies. One of those groups is called Strongblock. Strongblock is building a system to make businesses, enterprise scale businesses, be able to use EOS, and those guys had spent a ton of time. It was like a senior group of technical people at Block One who started Strongblock. Those guys came out and really helped us, the WAX team, figure out, hey, if we could do EOS over, delegated proof of stake, sort of voting over, how would we modify it? And so we took their advice. And we tried to really solve this voter apathy problem. And you can do that two ways, of course. There's carrots and there's sticks. You know, what do you do? Of course, there's, as you know, there's two types of people who basically own crypto. There's those who are trying to do something with them. They're a means to an end. They're a business tool. And then there are those who are investing in them and hoping that they, you know, make a decent return. You need both. You need entrepreneurs. You need venture capitalists. But it's the people actually working with the blockchain every day, like us, who I think are going to be pushing forward the developments of these chains in order to make them really applicable for large scale enterprise. It'll all. A big part of this is going to come down to how we get these communities who own these tokens to ensure that they stay engaged. And I know you guys do tremendous stuff in London, ensuring that people stay engaged with EOS, right? I remember I sadly missed one of your meetups, but I remember
you missed it when EOS Rules the World event, but that's okay. You'll come back for the next one.
I will, yeah. And I saw the pictures, several hundred people at your SVK headquarters.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but anyway, those are more some more technical thoughts about it. Still, I don't think there's any better way to get scale today than delegated proof of stake.
I completely agree with all of your points. And I think that, you know, slowly but surely, we are seeing more activity in regards to token holders themselves becoming more interested in the network itself. And I think there's a big education factor that has been taking place and is as well. You know, we're seeing more and more YouTubers out there, more and more credible, you know, because a lot of YouTubers in the ICO phase are non-credible. I think more and more credible people are coming out as kind of speakers and just providing education to people who don't know, you know what I mean? So that takes time for that to come through. And we've started to see that already, which is positive. But I really want to get your view on the gaming space, because I know that you have a deep understanding of blockchain as you've just brought us into and onto the loop to. But the gaming space itself, the gaming industry has had a big explosion recently with the introduction of blockchain. Do you think that all the hype around that is merited? And do you feel that there may be an overvaluation occurring in the gaming space? I've heard a few different people say different things. I'd just be interested to hear your thoughts on the matter.
Sure. Well, as you know, with valuations, man, if you want to be wrong, make a guess about valuations. in fact, as a venture capitalist over the years, when I've given educational seminars to young VCs about how to think about structuring a term sheet, inevitably the valuation subject comes up, and you could definitely spend many, many hours talking about it. But one thing to keep in mind is the hype, if you will, around a new technology causes people to make decisions very fast. They want to get in before the door slams shut, and they can't get in the best deals. So that leads to inevitably a spike in the valuations, often an overshoot of the valuation. So whatever the valuation is, you know, you raise money at 100 million USD. Maybe if more sober minds were looking at it, it would be 25 million. But here's the trick. It's often the case that the valuations are, given the risks, too high initially and much, much too low eventually. As the full spectrum of the potential of this new transformative technology takes hold, this has happened in every sector that I have invested in, which is why you might say then, well, maybe if you have a long-term view, even if you overpay initially, you will be fine in the long term. And I think that's the case. Lots of people, by the way, thought when Amazon went public, it went public at about 440 million USD, I want to say May 1997. People thought that was crazy for a company losing money that was doing retail stuff. VCs didn't think retail was very interesting. Now it's what, 900 billion? That's a pretty good return. And you see that again and again. So with respect to the video gaming space, I'd say time is also a factor. So there are hundreds of thousands of video games. There are probably millions, for sure, millions of video game developers. And there is going to be an education that they're going to have to go through to figure out what is the value of me using blockchain for my video game. And by the way, as an aside, I wish more people who get involved in blockchain crypto type activities would always start with that question. Like, what is it that the blockchain is going to do to make whatever thing I'm doing better? Ask yourself that. Don't say, could I use a blockchain? Say, how would a blockchain make it better?
I agree.
In video gaming, It's unlimited how many things could be made better. How do I know this? Because I've been involved in video gaming for over 20 years. And at the heart of video gaming is, in fact, it's the communal glue that brings video gaming together. It's trading. People love to trade their video game objects, but they don't like, as I talked about earlier, not actually owning these objects. And if you paid a dollar for an in-game virtual item, you may say, yeah, I don't own it, but whatever. But what if you paid $1,000 or $2,000 or $10,000 or $20,000, $50,000? These are prices people have paid for virtual items on my marketplace, Opskins. Think about that. When you pay that amount of money, it's pretty reasonable to say you should own it. And as we all know, there is no way to possess an item with more security on this earth than to have it locked in a blockchain. So I believe lots and lots of video game developers are going to eventually see the value, and they are going to use blockchain in ways even I can't fully understand. But the big opportunity initially is using a blockchain for an activity that they already do, and that is trading virtual items. So I see that, but how is it going to unfold? Now I'm really getting over my skis in terms of predictions, but what the hell? So I'll probably be wrong, but it helps to just put something out there for people to react to. So in most technology innovation cycles, I haven't actually seen it differently, but that doesn't mean it'll always be this way. But in most times when a new technology emerges, the big incumbent companies, let's talk video game in this case, the companies that are really happy, they're making tons of money, they're Fortnite, they're Activision, they're EA, they are Tencent, they're making tons of money. They like the existing business model, they like the existing technology, and frankly, why should they change? Don't expect those people to embrace a new technology, because frankly, they're already at the top. The best they can do with the new tech is stay at the top. So they're not going to experiment. Who is? Well, obviously the guys at the bottom. People who are just starting to build video games, or maybe they've got a small video game studio, and they're like, well, how could I differentiate myself? You're going to see those guys do it first. And if you look at the history of video gaming, that's exactly what happens. Video games, the digital era video games, I don't know when you want to say that began, but maybe we could say it began with Nolan Bushnell, you know, doing Atari and Pong. And then that was a dedicated machine that allowed you to go back and forth. After a while, people started thinking, wow, what if we could put these on general purpose PCs? Enter the era of PC video gaming. Then some people came along and said there really should be dedicated hardware to really power these graphics for video gaming. And you had consoles. Well, once consoles came about, the video game people who were doing PC gaming said, oh, these console guys are a joke. Like, PCs are much more adaptable, malleable. These consoles are toys. Well, guess what happened when browser-based games came about in the 1990s? Well, the video game, the PC guys and the console guys said, those aren't real games. Those are a joke. And then what happens? You get mobile gaming after the Apple iPhone in 2007. And yep, you can see what happened. The browser guys, the PC guys, the console guys all said, those aren't real video games. And it was the same thing in, 2011, 2012, when the very first game on a blockchain happened for you people in the audience, bit of trivia, Satoshi Dice. That was the first mainstream one. It was a gambling game, very good application for the blockchain. But everybody said those aren't real games. And but the young and the small game studios didn't really care. And they don't care because they're just trying to differentiate. So what I see is eventually you'll have all of these small studios and new developers who are using blockchain for gaming right now. They will be followed by the big incumbent companies who say, wow, maybe you guys are onto something. I do believe, by the way, that's probably several years. In fact, I would say, you know, 5+ years is what it'll take. Having said that, it's hard for me to see how that won't happen. Sometimes you wonder if a trend is going to either get its velocity to a point it infiltrates the entire industry or not. I don't see that happening here because as a video gamer, I see the value of what blockchain allows. And frankly, I also see how restrictive these platform companies are. Apple, when blockchain started to become popular, 2013, 2014, Apple just banned all blockchain related apps. No real reason. We don't really understand it. Forget it. Business people don't like it when one authority can ban their business. So I see a lot of opportunity for this next generation of video game developers to say, wow, we can be on a platform that's our own. Because the history of video gaming, at least in the PC era, has often been big platforms like Valve that runs Steam. EA and Activision, each of which have their own gaming environment. Of course, all of the console companies, you have to get permission. If you want to be on Xbox, you want to be on PlayStation. So it's kind of nice you don't need permission if it's blockchain based. And as far as the valuations go, my humble opinion, I'd say, I think I look at some of these first attempts and I think the valuations are a bit high. But you also know when it comes to video gaming, because it's a global phenomenon, you can go from one customer to 100 million customers in a very rapid period of time. And I think it's that upside potential that's causing these valuations to be pretty high right now.
I agree. And I think it's a really exciting time for the gaming industry. And to take it one step further, like I know you like to do, William, let's talk about non-fungible tokens and their role and what they're going to play in tomorrow's future, because we're seeing more and more adoption within that.
Yeah. So NFTs, non-fungible tokens, pretty simple. I would give credit. I know some people say there were versions of this before, but I'd give credit to the Ethereum folks who helped popularize the ERC 721 token standard, which is every token can be unique. That is there's an element of that in video gaming. And I would just say for those not super familiar with video gaming, most virtual items that you buy in a video game are not unique. I'll even define unique, one of a kind. They're not. There are a few video game companies that have unique virtual items. Like literally your virtual item is different from every other virtual item out there. The most famous of these would be Counter-Strike Global Offensive, also known as CSGO, and a very popular game where people trade these virtual items. They call them skins because remember, there's one type of virtual item that is a strictly cosmetic item. It doesn't have any utility. It's just a look. And CSGO is probably the best at popularizing that. And it was only a matter of time before the crypto community, and it happened with Ethereum, said we should have a token standard that would allow people to have unique virtual items. We then at OpSkins, we created a virtual item that's everyone's unique. It's called VGO, VGO. It became very popular, trading hundreds of thousands of times a day. It was really more of an experiment of ours to see, hey, since we really understand the recipe, what these virtual items, these unique virtual items should do. And how they should be made and how different they should be and all that. There really is a science behind it. we wanted to experiment with this on a mainstream level as a blockchain-based token. And I'd say Vigo trades more than all the other NFTs probably combined. So we got the recipe right. And it tells me that this concept is going to be one of those probably levers that helps catapult blockchain-based gaming forward. Because the truth is, the vast, vast majority of traditional video game developers do not have unique virtual items. Most of them, frankly, I don't even understand why somebody would want them. The video game world will eventually figure it out, but with NFT standard, true virtual items that are unique, what we've seen is a lot of video game, a lot of blockchain-based gaming people are promoting the fact that these one-of-a-kind items might be more valuable than a generic item. The only word of caution I would give is I think for a virtual item to have a ton of value as an NFT, it is necessary for, but not sufficient for that virtual item to be unique. It's not the case that just because it's unique, it's valuable. And in Gen 1 of blockchain-based gaming, which hit late 2017 with CryptoKitties, and now there's thousands of these blockchain-based gaming companies, virtually all of which use this non-fungible token standard. I think too many of them think that their tokens are valuable because they're unique. And that's not the case. By being unique, they can take on a lot of value, but they also have to incorporate other things. And so that could be for another maybe podcast. We can talk more about that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I would also say the NFT concept is evolving rapidly. Stay tuned. In 2019, you're going to be seeing some really terrific novel applications of NFTs. And I'm seeing them now. I like them. This is why I think it's going to be like an irresistible little honeypot that all the big video game companies are eventually going to say, we need to start doing blockchain-based gaming style things as well. And then there's going to be the struggle. And the struggle is going to be the blockchain mentality of virtual items belong to me, not the platform that spawned them. The video game company saying, we created these virtual items for our video game. We own them. You can lease them. This is going to be the clash.
Yeah, you know what? I actually agree with your prediction. I see that coming in, and it excites me because I see, like you do, a lot of activity, especially on the developer side with NFTs, a lot of exciting things happening. And that may be the one catalyst that really strikes to other developers out there that increases attention onto the gaming space and blockchain's involvement within that. But I really want to change gears very quickly and talk about Tether. Now, I know that you're one of the founders of Tether. Not many people know that, William. I don't know why, but not many people know that. Can you give us a story of what happened with Tether and what was your original vision with Tether? And did you see it becoming what it is today?
Well, if what it is today is defined as used a lot by people who trade cryptocurrencies, then absolutely. Three guys came up with the concept of Tether. And Tether, for your audience, we tokenized a U.S. dollar, right? So we made a token. We linked each token to a U.S. dollar so that if you got a Tether, you would know that that was redeemable for a U.S. dollar. So that was the concept. Brock Pierce, some of your audience may know, me, William Quigley, and then Jonathan Yantis, the guy who brought me and Brock Pierce into crypto. He was the guy who kept telling us in 2010, 11, 12, we finally listened to him in 12, get into this stuff. So the three of us came up with the concept for it, formed a company. We hired a guy named Reeve Collins, who became a co-founder. And we said, we have a problem with, because we were crypto traders, we think we figured out a way to solve it. So Tether, really simply, here was the problem we were trying to solve. And nothing's changed, by the way. So anyone who trades virtual items today will completely understand what I'm saying. But believe it or not, throughout the history of crypto, they've been highly volatile. And there are some days as a trader, you lose your shit. And you just want to get away from the volatility. Now, you can, right? Now, at the time, there were just a few exchanges that allowed you to use fiat, and very few, fiat meaning deposit cash. And in order to sell your very volatile crypto and then take cash, that process was not useful. And the reason is, you could only do it on a few exchanges. And it turned out essentially every exchange that allowed you to deposit fiat and withdraw fiat only had a few tokens. They didn't have what we used to call the altcoins. Altcoins was essentially anything other than Bitcoin. And now it's probably anything other than Bitcoin and Ethereum. So whereas most people are like, well, that's everything. Yeah, but initially there were just a few tokens. So you would go to alt exchanges, and alt exchange was a place that traded all of these weird little things like Mastercoin at the time and Litecoin coins like eventually things like Augur and such. Well, here's what you would have to do if you were scared about the volatility or want to protect your downside. You would sell your altcoin on the exchange, this alt exchange, for Bitcoin. Then you would take the Bitcoin and transfer it to one of the few exchanges that had USD or fiat cash out. Then you would request the cash out on that exchange. They would do a wire. 3-4 days later, you'd get your wire. Okay, so two bad things happened with that. First, you took 4 or 5 days to actually get out and get your money. During that time, by the way, you probably wanted to get back in and be exposed once again to trading volatility, because that's what you're doing. But as you sold those cryptos for fiat money, guess what else happened? You triggered a taxable gain. So it takes a long time, and you have fees because you're jumping from exchange to exchange, and you trigger a taxable gain. So those are not good things. So our thinking was this: what if you could, on the alt exchange, transfer your Litecoin to something we'll call Tether, which was backed by a US dollar, so that the price of that thing never moved? And at the time, at least in the United States, if you went from one coin to another coin, you did not trigger a taxable gain. You had what we called a 1031 tax-deferred exchange for you geeks. So you could go between risky, high-volatility crypto and to a place where you had no volatility while you were, you know, collecting your nerves instantly and without any taxable effect. That was the idea behind Tether. And what I can tell you is... We formed a company, a Real USD. I think it was a US company. We built the tech. We built it on Mastercoin. We hired a guy named Craig Sellers. Craig Sellers was a developer on Mastercoin. And so we then needed to get a bank, right? So anyone who does crypto knows this: banking is your Achilles heel. It was very, very hard to get a bank. Eventually, we got in touch with the guys who were operating an exchange called Bitfinex, and they had a bank. And so we partnered with them. And I think we sold them 40% of the company. They invested, they got us banking. And I'll say this, Everyone gets Tether, what now we call stable coins. I think everybody gets them today. It was like so many new things. It took a year to get like mainstream crypto traders to understand it. Most of them would say, but US dollars are already digitized. Like, how does tokenizing a US dollar help? And it's like, well, okay, I guess you're not familiar with the, you know, the SWIFT network, the banking system, how slow it is, the fees, the fact that you've got taxable issues. So it took a while, but once people started to use it, they never went back. And we would go around to different exchanges and we would tell them, hey, this is how it works. One point I'll make is Tether was a project that was communal and what I would call a charitable project in this sense. There was no way and no motivation for us to make money with Tether directly. We were not trying to make money with Tether. We were trying to solve a problem that all blockchain people had. And that was, if you're trading, you have these issues getting in and out of fiat. Tether now trades on an annual basis, I want to say between $3 and $4 trillion US dollars. So it's been phenomenally successful. And now I think there's hundreds of what we call stable coins. Of all people, I guess JP Morgan is now, and for those of you who are here the way I'm putting it this way, JP Morgan's creating a stablecoin. And that's very, very strange to me because Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, has for years said blockchain and crypto is just a terrible idea. It's pointless, doesn't add any value. Really? So now you see the value, Mr. Dimon. Being able to tokenize a US dollar and being able to very swiftly transact cross-border instantly is a thing that you could really only do where there would be enough trust in that item on a blockchain. And so I'm very proud of what we did with Tether. And I hope that it continues for a long time. I'll say this one thing. We eventually, by the way, turned all the operations of Tether, it might have been 2016, I don't recall the exact date, over to the Bitfinex people. There's been controversy, of course. I'm sure your listeners are saying, yeah, there's been controversy about Tether. Is it really backed by US dollars? Everything I knew about Tether when I was involved, yes, I can say unequivocally, we had, for every Tether, there was a US dollar. And I would be very surprised if the Bitfinex team running Tether today doesn't have dollar for dollar backing of Tether. They're very rich guys. They are under a lot of regulatory scrutiny. It would be ridiculous if they did not do that. There'd be no reason not to. And it's also a way of saying, for those of you who are thinking about ideas that could benefit all crypto people, it's very satisfying when you do it. I'd encourage people to do it because blockchain is, I think, because of its roots as an open source movement, it's a quite communal type of business. In the end, you do need for-profit oriented companies to really commercialize things at scale. That's just the way it is. But these ideas can come from just about anybody. And if somebody says, oh, my idea is, you know, people don't think your idea is very good or whatever, just remember, stable coins as a concept, we were out there for a year with people telling us it was unnecessary. I mean, you kind of go, really? So what seems obvious today doesn't always seem obvious maybe at the time it was introduced, which is, of course, one of the reasons why entrepreneurs come up with new ideas and make a lot of money when they do hit on something that everybody eventually realizes cool. Who thought summoning a car driven by a random guy instead of a taxi would have been a great idea, right? Well, it might have sounded crazy until, or renting out your room to a complete stranger, you know, hello Airbnb. things that seem crazy become normalized very fast. It's also very interesting, by the way, that so for people who say, well, but, you know, yes, there are things that Tether should do. I would say this one bit of advice, if they ever wanted to listen to me, I would give to Bitfinex is, guys, have a audit by a reputable international public accounting firm, you know, Deloitte or Price Waterhouse or whatever, KPMG, have an audit once a month, whatever. Of the cash balance. It's not hard. But clearly we can also say, and they would probably say this to me, why do we need to do that? It's trading $3 to $4 trillion a year. No one seems to care. But I do think it would be better for the overall community if it happened. And one last thing I'll say about Tether. Tether is very simple, right? For every Tether token, there's a US dollar somewhere in a bank account. During 2017 and 2018, I'm sure you guys saw this too, I saw dozens of new forms of stable coins, coins backed in some way by a hard asset. Virtually everyone I saw, I said to the teams, you know what, guys, it's too complicated. The reason people like Tether is because it's easy to understand. Every Tether is backed by a dollar. And there were all kinds of weird, like, monetary policy type mechanisms people were trying to do with newfangled stablecoins. I did not think they were going to be widely adopted, because I think the average guy just wants to know, can I redeem this for a buck? That's what they want. Hence, the simplicity of Tether is probably a great reason for why it remains the absolute dominant stablecoin out there.
Well, William, listen, we've learned a lot. We've learned about your view on delegated proof of stake, your views on Ethereum and Ethereum's ability to scale. We've learned a lot about the gaming industry, your in-depth understanding of that. We've learned a lot about Tether and the fact that you shouldn't just give up. You should just keep going no matter what people say, because they're normally wrong and you'll be proved right at some point. How long you have to wait for that, that's up to you. But you got to keep going, keep pushing forward. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I know you're super busy, and we really appreciate it. And we look forward to having you back in London again. When are you next in town?
So it'll probably be, I'm thinking July. As I mentioned, the WAX blockchain launches on June 30. In fact, for those listeners who are listening, this podcast, I guess, will be in the past by the time they're listening to this, but you can check it out at wax.io. And we're doing some very cool stuff with NFTs and with novel ways of encouraging voting on DPoS-oriented blockchains. And we hope it's a well-received contribution to the blockchain world. It is going to be very important, WAX and other chains, ultimately, for going mainstream with the video gaming blockchain world, which I do believe video gaming is the consumer mass market on-ramp for widespread adoption of blockchain-based technologies. Because so many people do video gaming, and so many people in video gaming like virtual assets and like to trade them. That's a lot of the sort of thing that blockchain can do better. So hopefully I'll see you guys in July in
London.
Let's
make it happen. And is there a Telegram the community can join for the announcement or upcoming announcements for the WAX blockchain?
Yeah, the WAX. Yeah, just go on Telegram, the wax.io Telegram. There's a couple of Telegram channels. There's the main one, and then there's, you know, like any chain, you'll see side branches. But if they go to Telegram, they type in WAX, they'll see the community Telegram channel that we help run. And we put a lot of stuff in there about our views on video gaming and on just NFTs in general, and what drives people to trade, what drives consumers to trade virtual items.
Awesome. Listen, William, thank you once again for coming on the show. Your insight, your experience is invaluable. Thank you so much for making it on. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you. Loved doing it.
I want to say a big thank you once again to William for making it on the show today.
I know he has a very, very busy schedule, so we really appreciate his time, his energy, and his dedication for making it on the show today. If you haven't already, hit us up on Telegram, type in SVK Crowd, you'll find us. Follow us on Twitter at @SVK_crypto. And if you have any questions, queries, or projects relating to EOS, feel free to email myself, CStory@svkcrypto.com. That's a wrap, and I've got to bounce.